Hello and welcome to On Science. I'm Alison Richards, NPR Science Editor. This week, a large snake, a newly hatched dinosaur, and sudden death. We'll hear about the fossilised action scene. Then, in case you've ever wondered, we find out what happens to mosquitoes in the winter and why mussels, the ones with the shells, have such tough beards. We also have more on ice sheets in Antarctica, the earthquake in Chile, and your ability to hear this podcast with your skin. We start with Chile. The earthquake that rocked that country last week was so big at an 8.8 magnitude that it may have caused a chunk of the Earth's crust to shift westward by at least 6 feet. Scientists at NASA calculate that this shift changed how the Earth moved on its axis and actually shortened the length of the day. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
You might think of the Earth as a perfectly spinning top, but that's not quite true. Richard O'Connell at Harvard University says the Earth actually wobbles a bit as it spins.
The consequence of that is that the rotation pole actually moves, and it moves around over an area about the size of a tennis court.
This is called the Chandler wobble. And back in the mid-1970s, O'Connell wrote a paper that showed how big earthquakes keep kicking the Earth, and by so doing, keep the Earth wobbling. Now we know that's not quite the whole story behind the wobble.
Subsequent work by other people showed that the atmospheric excitation is also very significant and also changes in ocean currents.
So sloshing oceans and the large-scale movement of air masses like typhoons can also shift mass around on the Earth enough to change the way it wobbles. All this shifting around can also change the speed at which the Earth spins, and that, of course, affects the length of a day. So along comes this week's earthquake, and folks at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory quickly calculated how much the Earth's rotation should have changed. Their answer? A day on Earth should have gotten shorter by a millionth of a second, and the Earth's wobbly axis should have shifted by about 3 inches within that tennis court-sized area where it tends to wander. But did it? Brian Luzum's job at the U.S. Naval Observatory is to keep tabs on the Earth's rotation and orientation. And he says even the best instruments in the world can't measure a change in day length as small as a millionth of a second. It is possible to measure the Earth's wobble pretty precisely, but considering how many things affect the Earth's wobble, it's hard to see the effect of the quake as well.
So on a day-to-day basis, we actually will see changes on the order of 2 or 3 inches happening every day. And to try to pick out this one particular signal in and among all the other signals, just not really feasible.
The one hope was that the quake changed the wobble so abruptly that would show up in the data, Luzum said.
That's what you would like to be able to see to give you that eureka moment. And, of course, when we do look at the data, no such jump exists.
Theory says it happened, but the observations thus far aren't good enough to back that up. But if these planetary effects are trivial on a day-to-day basis, they can really add up over geological time. Adam Maloof at Princeton University notes that ice has been melting over the past 12,000 years as we come out of the last ice age, and that's changing the Earth's orientation by about an inch each and every year.
You can imagine that as the ice melts, you're redistributing the mass on the surface of the Earth. So all this water that was, you know, caught up in the ice at the poles is melting and moving into the oceans at lower latitudes.
And if you go way back in time to a period 800 million years ago, this kind of movement was dramatic. Over the course of a few million years, the landmass at the North Pole shifted monumentally, sliding south by 50 degrees.
That's basically taking New York to the equator, or even better, you're taking Paris to the equator.
Nobody knows why this happened, although Maloof says one idea is that a huge volcanic plume, like the one that created the Hawaiian Islands, developed near one of the poles, and that lopsided mass forced the Earth to rotate.
And would have had major ramifications for sea level, climate, landscape equilibrium, all sorts of effects like this.
And as for a single day's event, like the Chilean quake, well, it's fair to say that event touched hearts around the world more tangibly than it changed the spin of our planet. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Fossil finds that show animal behavior, and not just animal remains, are very rare. So the discovery of a dramatic death scene that took place 67 million years ago has researchers pretty excited. It involves a very large snake, a newly hatched dinosaur, and some crafty detective work. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
When Jeffrey Wilson was a student, he was fascinated by stories of fields of dinosaur eggs found in India. Later, as a professor at the University of Michigan, he visited the scientists in India who showed him a broken fossilized egg encased in a briefcase-sized block of stone. He leaned in to take a closer look and saw something else.
And I was stunned when I saw it because, you know, sort of leaping out at me were the peculiar articulations between the vertebrae of a snake. And so I had no idea that there was going to be a snake there, but there it was, sitting in front of me.
With permission from the Indian government, Wilson put the stone in his backpack and flew home. He emphasizes that he did not check the bag. Wilson spent a year cleaning the stone, and bit by bit it revealed more of the egg and more of the snake. But it's what the snake was doing that turned this rare find into something even more unusual, a grim tableau right out of a science fiction movie.
It was amazing because we realized that not only do we have an egg, not only do we have a chain of vertebrae, but they're arranged in a coil, and on top of the coil was a skull.
The snake was coiled around the broken eggshell. But wait, there's more.
Next to that coil, eggshell, skull was a solid egg and another solid egg, and then some larger bones.
Those bones belonged to a baby sauropod. Full-grown sauropods were the vegetarian 100-ton giants of the dinosaur world, but the baby was only about a foot and a half long. It had apparently just hatched from that broken egg. The snake, about 11 feet long, had been waiting for the baby to hatch in order to eat it. Wilson says scientists have since found three snake fossils and more eggs at the same site this one came from, and they add new details to a 67-million-year-old story.
So the sauropods, these big dinosaurs, would come in, they would use their hind limb and probably kick out a small depression, they would squat down, they would lay a clutch of 6 to 12 eggs, they would cover it up with a little layer of sediment and maybe some vegetation, and then they would leave it.
And the snakes knew that.
Anaconda meets Jurassic Park.
That's Jason Head, a paleontologist at the University of Toronto who worked with Wilson's team.
These sauropods would lay these huge fields of eggs, kind of kilometers of dinosaur eggshell. And so with these hatchling dinosaurs, it must have just been a smorgasbord where an ecosystem of predators could basically come in and feed on them.
In this case, a sudden avalanche of sand or mud must have intervened and buried both prey and predator like entombed Romans at Pompeii. The scientists call the snake Sanaja indicus. It did not have a modern snake's jaw, which basically unhinges so the snake can swallow large prey, but instead had a jaw more like a lizard. Head says the snake probably made up for that by growing very large. So did the sauropods, which probably grew very fast as well, given their apparent tastiness. The discovery is described in the journal PLOS Biology. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
The art of staying alive when you are someone else's tasty morsel is a theme of our next story too. If you've ever steamed mussels, you'll know all about tearing off the mussel beards before you put them in the pot. That bushy bundle of tough threads is what mussels use to anchor themselves to rocks or piers. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, scientists have only just figured out how this stringy beard can have such an iron grip.
Living on a rocky seashore isn't easy. Matt Harrington says it's not just the endless crashing waves that are trying to rip mussels off the rocks.
But also they're being blasted with debris like small pieces of sand and other debris in the water that are basically acting like sandblasting and creating these really abrasive environments to live in.
Still, the mussels hang on tight with the help of their beard.
And these fibers are stiff but stretchy, and they basically function as kind of a holdfast and a shock absorber.
Harrington works at one of the Max Planck Institutes in Potsdam, Germany, where he tries to get ideas for new man-made materials by studying ones found in nature. He says the mussel's beard has a combination of stretchy and hard that's unusual.
To combine these two properties hasn't really been achieved yet in engineering materials.
So he and his colleagues wanted to see how mussels did it, and they're reporting their findings in the journal Science. It turns out the beard threads have a core of a soft material similar to what you'd find in a tendon. That's surrounded by a hard coating. The coating is made of proteins laced together with atoms of iron. What's more,
the coating has this really kind of weird, rough texture, very like knobby.
Harrington says tiny cracks can form in the threads, but only in between these knobby bits. That distributes damage over the length of the thread and lets it stretch without completely breaking as the muscle gets pummeled by the waves. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Animals trying to survive the winter have several options. They can head south for a vacation home in Florida or Mexico, or just hang a do not disturb sign on the door of their caves and wait till spring. Now, we all know that's what bears do, but as NPR's Joe Palka reports, mosquitoes do it too.
Technically speaking, mosquitoes don't hibernate. Although if you really want to get technical about it, some scientists say bears don't hibernate either. They just go into a kind of deep winter sleep. But getting back to mosquitoes, what they do is go into a state called diapause. David Denglinger says it's a state where mosquitoes
essentially shut down their development and just hunker it out until spring comes.
Denglinger is an entomologist at The Ohio State University in Columbus. He studies a common backyard mosquito called Culex pipiens. Not all Culex pipiens make it to spring.
The males die, and only the females overwinter.
And like bears, the females start storing fat as winter approaches.
They have a structure we call the fat body that's much like the liver of mammals, and much of the fat ends up in that structure, although it's there in also in their blood and other tissues as well.
And we're not talking just a smidge of fat.
Females that go into diapause probably have 10 times the fat accumulation that a non-diapausing mosquito has.
That's a fat mosquito. Culex pipiens isn't the only insect Denglinger studies. He's interested in how all cold-blooded insects make it through harsh winters.
We were sitting around one day and thought, you know, we really should push this to the limit sometime.
So Denglinger and some colleagues mounted an expedition to Antarctica.
There is one insect that is endemic to that continent. It's found only there.
A wingless fly, of all things.
That's Rick Lee from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He was on the Antarctic expedition. The wingless fly, or midge as some call it, is the only insect species to survive in Antarctica through the ages. And it has some amazing strategies.
First, it retains its capacity to survive being frozen solid.
Lee says it does this by making sugars and sugar alcohols that protect cell membranes.
They also produce something called heat shock proteins.
These are special molecules cells usually make only when they're under severe distress. The midges appear to make them all the time. And the midge has one more trick up its sleeve.
It can also tolerate severe dehydration.
We're talking really severe dehydration. In the larval stage, it can lose most of its body water.
These little larvae look like raisins when you dry them out like this. They look terrible. They look for sure that they would be dead. You put them in water, they plump up, and they wiggle away.
Of course, it's not much of a life, being a flightless midge in Antarctica. They spend 2 years in this raisin stage. Then, in the summer,
the adults emerge. They mate and lay their eggs and probably only live about 10 to 14 days.
Seems like a lot of work for not much reward. But Lee says for any species, there's really only one requirement for success.
Whether you can reproduce and leave offspring, that's the bottom line.
An appropriate thought as we head towards spring. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
Antarctica may be cold, but that doesn't mean it's not melting. In fact, new research shows that the continent's ice is melting in more places than previously recognized. NPR's Guy Raz recently spoke to scientist Jane Ferrigno of the U.S. Geological Survey about the Antarctic Peninsula's retreating ice.
In Antarctica, you'll find 90% of the world's glacial ice. But new research from the U.S. Geological Survey shows that every ice front in the southern part of the Antarctic Peninsula is retreating. Jane Ferrigno is the lead author of that new report. She says scientists have known for a while that some of the peninsula's ice shelves are breaking up.
That started at least a decade ago in the northern part of the peninsula. But we looked at all the ice fronts on the peninsula from north to south, In the southern area, we're finding that all the ice fronts are retreating. In the northern part of the peninsula, the majority of ice fronts are retreating. And that's something we neither expected, but we're highly interested in finding that out.
Now, the peninsula, the area where this research was focused on, is sort of like the canary in the coal mine, right? I mean, what does it tell us about larger trends?
The fact that the ice shelves are changing on the peninsula is a significant signal that global change, climate warming, is affecting the ice cover of Antarctica. It's affecting first the area that's towards the north, that's slightly warmer, but the effect of the warming has traveled from the northern part of the peninsula to the southern part of the peninsula, where it's colder. Our next concern is to see exactly what's happening in the continent itself. We've seen some changes there, but we need to look closely and see what else might be happening.
Hmm. Give us a sense of how much ice has been lost over the past, say, 10 years.
I think I'll go back 20 years. Hmm. And in the last 20 years, I would say at least 20,000 square kilometers of ice has been lost. And that's comparable to an area somewhere between the state of Texas and the state of Alaska.
So about the size of the state of Texas in terms of ice has been lost in the past 20 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Can we measure the consequences, you know, here in North America? I mean, have we been able to see ocean levels rise as a result?
Well, this is a fairly small amount of ice when you consider the whole Antarctic continent consists of about 13 million square kilometers of ice.
I mean, it sounds so dramatic, the size of Texas, right?
It is very dramatic, and it is larger than the size of Texas. But when you consider the entire Antarctic ice sheet, it's still a fairly minimal amount. But the thing that we're really interested in seeing is that this is a sort of a red flag, because if the warming continues, if the retreat continues, if the amount of ice on the continent starts to flow into the water, then there will be substantial impact to the sea level.
That's Jane Ferrigno. She's a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jane Ferrigno, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
If you've listened this far, your ears probably didn't need much help. But when you can't quite hear what someone is saying, you might want to try listening with your skin. Yes, you did hear that correctly, your skin. NPR's John Hamilton has details of some research that shows sensations on the skin can help you understand speech.
It's been clear for a long time that hearing involves more than just our ears. Brian Jick is a professor of phonetics at the University of British Columbia.
From our brain's point of view, we can hear with our eyes.
Chick says that's why people in a noisy room are more likely to understand someone if they can see the speaker's lips. But Chick wanted to see whether hearing could also be influenced by our sense of touch. So we had a graduate student round up some volunteers. They listened to a person making speech sounds, pa, ba, ta, da. Meanwhile, the graduate student stood by with a turkey baster.
She would squirt a little puff of air from the turkey baster onto the neck of the perceiver. And people had very strong responses to it.
Specifically, people did a much better job recognizing certain consonants when they were accompanied by a puff of air. That's not as odd as you might think. The sounds in question were pa and ta. To make those sounds, the mouth sends out a little burst of air. In contrast, the sounds ba and da do not come with a burst. And the brain seems to know that. Jick confirmed this with a high-tech version of the turkey baster experiment. He used an automated device to deliver tiny, precisely timed puffs of air to a person's hand or neck while they listened to audio recordings with a lot of background noise.
Pa, ba, ta, da.
What we found was that the little puff of air would cause them to be more likely to report having heard a sound like pa, even if what had actually been played to them was ba.
Jick says what's really interesting about this is that people don't normally use their skin to understand speech, yet they did it automatically. Jick says that suggests our brains are wired to incorporate information from other senses when we listen.
From my point of view, we're whole body perceiving machines, and we just take all of the information that comes at us in our environment and merge it into a percept of something that happened in the world.
That's an idea that's becoming widely accepted among brain scientists. David Ostry is a professor of psychology at McGill University in Montreal. A few months ago, he did a different experiment that involved touch and hearing.
We put small plastic tabs on the side of the cheeks, and we had a robot basically pull on the facial skin.
People did a better job recognizing a sound if the robot tugged their facial skin in the same direction it would have moved if they'd been making the sound themselves. Ostry says these days, the big scientific question isn't whether our brains routinely integrate sensory information, but how.
Really, it's up for grabs where within the brain this kind of integration is happening.
Ostry says it could be happening in areas that process sensory information, or in the motor cortex, which controls our muscles. Research on how hearing is influenced by other senses could help people with hearing loss, or people like airline pilots who need to understand speech in noisy environments. The new study appears in the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And that's all for On Science this week. If you'd like to hear and read more stories, visit our website, npr.org/science. Thanks for listening. I'm Alison Richards.